A cinephile or not a cinephile? That is the question.
Oh, that's a good question. Because today, after 6 years of hosting this podcast, won't make so much sense for the YouTube channel, but it's graduation day for one of us right now on Movie Mount Rushmore.
Hey, screeners, how you doing? It's me, the one AJ, Anthony Jordan.
And it's me too, Nico Liro. We are back with our weekly top 10 show right here on our YouTube channel, The Silver Screen Dudes. Subscribe if you haven't already. Tickle the notification bell so you can always stay notified whenever we have a new video releases. Spoiler alert, it's basically every day. But the top 10 show releases every single Tuesday, so you should never miss it. Make sure you're subscribed to our channel. And it's a huge day here. And Movie Mount Rushmore. We're not going to dawdle long because we know that the attention span and our retention as a result is very limited with modern audience. But for this episode, we have to give a teeny tiny bit of context. This all started with what has now become an infamous and notorious episode on our old YouTube channel, which is when we did episode 200 of the podcast. And we got in, I'm not going to repeat what the debate was, but it was in relevance to the Banshees of Inisherin. And I was going quite deep with it. And AJ, amongst the four people we had on the podcast, I could see was visibly the only one who is keeping up with me on this. The others were agreeing with my points, but AJ was right there, laser focused with me. And they were trying to make out that, what's the point? It's just movies. It's just entertainment. No. I've always said this, the point of view of a critic, which I have never claimed we are, I have always said AJ and myself are pundits. We look at movies almost, we comment on movies the way that the analysts on Match of the Day do about football. We have an opinion, and it's an informed opinion. And our opinion, my opinion, is better and more informed and greater than the average person who goes to see four movies a year. Why? Because I watch between 150 to 300 new movies a year. AJ, I know, doesn't watch that many, but I know also watches a lot of new movies a year. Statistically, your average film fan watches between 4 to 10 new movies a year. That doesn't touch what we watch. Now, does that mean that our opinion is better than your, is more valid than yours? No. If we've both watched the same movie and we both have a different liking for it, if you like it and we don't, that doesn't mean you're wrong. Vice versa as well. However, what we do have the ability to do on the simple basis that we watch so many movies is that we have more material to draw from when we're making a critical evaluation of something. We can see what has inspired that, what has informed the director's decision to film a shot a certain way, why he has written a character a certain way. Why? That's the dividing line between a film buff, a film fan, we'll call it, and a cinephile. AJ and I, and this, we're not trying to sound snooty here, it just is what it is, are now at a stage where we definitely still absorb movies as a form, first and foremost, of entertainment. Nothing makes us jump out of our seats more than Captain America picking up Mjolnir in Endgame. Happy times. Whole cinema applauds. Everyone in the movie's happy. Doesn't matter how many movies you've seen. Good times lie ahead. However, we also have the ability to look at how that scene was shot and be like, he got that idea from X movie, or, the charging of the battle. That's a direct inspiration from Y. We're able to, as well as enjoy it, also analyze it analytically and critically. Not because we're super smart. I'd argue the opposite. Neither of us is super smart. But just on the basis that we have been watching so many movies each and every year, our opinion is more informed. Not better, but more informed. It has transitioned into being the opinion of a cinephile. I have always maintained I've been a cinephile for longer than AJ has, and today is graduation day for AJ because he's pushed back on me so hard. Say, like, I'm not a cinephile. And then I've been listening to him over the course of the last year, 2 years, the way he's been breaking down movies. Go listen to AJ in episode one of season one on our podcast, and then listen to AJ talk about a movie now. You will see and hear an evolution of a man who looks at movies in such a different way now than he did 6 years ago. AJ, my friend, welcome to Club Snob.
So, I mean, again, we're not gonna draw out, because we don't draw out anymore. It's not the old channel. Six seasons worth of different varieties and categories of films gives you a wide range of films. And I, you know, there's a saying on the show, death, taxes, and comic book movies. That's me, you know, that's who I am. I'm the guy talking comic book movies. Because of the variety of topics, you are now open to a wider world. So do I believe that you can come and tell me, you can educate me about a shot? Anyone can. And that's even if you have watched one film for the year. I maintain that. However, the variety, for me, to say, if you are a fan of film, not an action film fan, or a comedy film fan, or a romance or a drama fan, a fan of film, here's a selection of films that we should say are here for historic reasons or landmark reasons. And for that, I will accept the cinephile title. I will not maintain that I can be like, oh, well, at that point, I can see that Midnight was ascending. And I even, no. Variety and appreciation and different scopes of view and appreciation is why I will accept this title. I maintain that certain cinephiles, historical cinephiles, will be like, this guy and it's clueless, and I will hold that title and I will accept it. However, the selection I have will have its selection. There are films that I have been very tempted to put out there, but I've held back for reasons, and I will explain along the way.
Well, as long as you accept the title, we're good.
Now, after all of this long ramble of why we've built this top 10, would you like to tell people the movie Mount Rushmore is actually all about?
Yes, it's basically a top 10 show between two best friends dating all the way back to school. So this is how the way the show works. AJ and I each get assigned a topic, we go our separate ways, and we come right back here into the video for you, our silver screen dudes, our film familia, and we deliver to you, which we've made separately, our individual top 10s. This week, maybe fittingly, I will go first delivering my bottom three. AJ will then deliver his bottom three. I will deliver my next two. AJ will deliver his next two. And then when we get to our top five, we will trade one apiece. If at any time, as we are rounding off our individual top 10 movies, one person has a movie in a higher position, that person will say,
punt.
And we will punt and talk about that movie when we get to the higher position. And once we have both rounded off our individual top 10 lists, we will combine and create, in the voice of Chandler Bing, the movie Mount Rushmore. These are the four quintessential diverse must-see movies of the genre, which this week is.
Top 10 movies every cinephile must watch. Okay, guys. Now, before we go into that.
No, Paul. I messed up. I forgot to message JT.
Okay. So then normally you will then go over to Twitter, you will go to JT, and you will vote for El Capitan, El Best of the Best. Yeah, you'll hear the spill later on when it's time to do it. Let's just go on and let's hit me with your number 10, sir.
Whew, okay. So with my number 10, AJ, what I decided, so with the whole list, I have, what I've thought of is that there's definitely, you and me have both got like bucket lists and potholes and blind spots as we've been growing our movie knowledge, right? And we, you know, as we've been going, you know, some movies we've seen, which we know are great movies, and some movies that, oh, I've really got to get around to watching that one day, right? And I believe that as we get older and as there are more generations of people that come into the world, there are truly some, not just cinema-altering, but life-alteringly good movies, which as they get older, people will have less and less chance to see and probably hear less and less about, despite the fact that they're so influential. For my entire list, I haven't gone just with the whole, oh, I'm going to find some stuff that's obscure as possible and trying to sound really hipster and trendy. No. These are movies that are known, but that I believe that not enough people may have, number one, heard of, which is unfortunate, but possible, or two seen, okay? But they're all, we've talked about them on the show before, and they're all widely regarded as all-timers. But being all-timers, people still may not have seen them. So with all that said, AJ, we have to start classic here. Now, I'm going to the Charlie Chaplin era, but I'm not going with Charlie Chaplin on the basis that Charlie Chaplin's name is big enough. It has echoed through time. People will talk about Charlie Chaplin, and I'm putting it down to blind hope that people will hear the name and go, oh, I've never seen a Charlie Chaplin movie. Let me go and see what this guy's all about. However, his generational counterpart, who is never as big a star, but I think we would argue might even be more impressive than him, is Mr. Buster Keaton. Buster Keaton needed to be in there. And my number 10, I've gone with the General. For all the reasons I just said. Now, when you think about the General is a very simple premise. They copied it in that Denzel Washington and Chris Pine movie. The one about the train that gets away.
Unstoppable,
That's basically the General. That's literally the story of the General.
But it's based on real life, but yeah, it's all, yeah.
Of course, but they literally follow the same beats as the General movie does, right? And when you consider that this film is made, and I really encourage any aspiring cinephile, it's on YouTube. Like, you don't even need to AJ vision this. The movie, just The General. There's like many versions of it on YouTube, as in many different channels having it. You consider that this man is performing without the aid of any modern technology, without the aid of modern safety protocols. He is on a fast-moving train performing his own stunts that are so outrageously out of this world that they almost appear to be cartoonish, such as the ridiculousness of them. You know, this is a man who climbs to the front of the train and attempts to stop the train while it's moving with his feet. This is a man who tries to derail the train with a tree log by throwing a tree log on. And it's like he's doing all of his own stunts and he's really risking his own life. He was the first original jackass, as far as I'm concerned. But he is, it's because of Buster Keaton that the role of the stuntman in Hollywood is now so sacred and well trained and revered, and why it remains such a fallacy that we still don't have the best stunt in Hollywood for the Oscars. But that's neither here nor there. The General is an absolute must watch for anyone who likes the big spectacle blockbuster. Started here.
Is it not John Wick that pays tribute to Buster?
Yeah, Keaton? John Wick too. They play a big very well. Yeah, Mr. Cinephile, there you go. yeah. You literally proven my point. At the beginning of John Wick 2, as they pan down onto Keanu's crazy Mustang chase, they've got an image and video of Buster Keaton being projected onto the building. Well done, AJ. 10 points to Gryffindor. My number 9. I would argue the most influential comedy of all time, but not a comedy that necessarily gives you yuck-yucks. AJ, I'm going to go with Some Like It Hot.
Nice. Don't get me wrong. I know I've seen it. I always remember the end of the film. I remember parts of it in between. It was when I was a film student, so it's not one that I need to brush up on. Some Like It Hot. That's my thing.
A movie that somehow treads the line between being a runaway from the mob, you know, a gangster film, because the beginning's heavy. Like, these two musicians witness a murder, a mob hit, and then the mob are aware that they've seen their hit and go after them. And so to hide from the mob, they both join an all-female band and they have to cross-dress for the whole movie. At the head of this band is big star Marilyn Monroe, arguably the biggest movie star of all time. And you've got Tony Curtis and Jack Lemmon acting as a troublesome duo hiding from the mob there's a cat and mouse thing that happens at the end, but there's this brilliant non-laugh, but still, it definitely has to get defined as a comedy. This brilliant kind of double act with Tony Curtis having to both pretend like he's obviously still part of this all-female band dressing as a woman, but also, as a man, seduce Marilyn Monroe, who he's got the hots for. And, you know, you look at this and it's like, well, I see where Mrs. Doubtfire got some ideas from, huh? Mrs.
Doubtfire, White Chicks, yeah. Nuns on the Run.
Yeah.
Like, there are so many different comedies and films.
There you go. There you go.
Here we go again.
Here you go, brother. Look at you go. That's what I'm saying. And it's so ahead of its time. I mean, Jesus, the fact that we're still debating, like, what is okay to say, what is okay to do, what is okay to depict in the year 2023. Here we are with one of the greatest closing lines of a film ever. I'm not a woman. Nobody's perfect.
Yeah. I mean, this is open and liberal as you can get, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this was, what, in the 50s, that this movie came out? Maybe before. Can't remember the year. But it's an all-time influential comedy. And shout out to Andy Hart at Fandango Groover. I know this is your favorite movie, Andy. If you're listening or watching, love to you, mate. And my number eight, AJ. I toyed with putting this on because it's more recent. But then I was like, well, just because it's recent shouldn't be a benchmark for it not making it on the list. We're talking about influential must-watch cinephile movies here. But it's not that recent, as one of our recent Throwback Thursdays showed. 30 years old this year, but it's still absolutely deserving and an all-time movie, Steven Spielberg's Jurassic Park.
That's a punt. We have our first punt of the show.
Yes, boy!
Okay, cool. Right. Okay, here we go, here we go. So you brought up The General as something that's available on a non-AJ Vision way of being a cinephile and respecting what the past has delivered to us. And that was for Stunt. I'm now going to go back in time. We both done this one, funny enough. And it's to acknowledge sci-fi. So we are going to go all the way back to 1902 and take a trip to the moon. Now, it's one of the... It's a short film. It's not something that is going to be... Like you talked about timeless classics that haven't been seen. If you want to talk about, dare I say, this is really embarrassing because I like the director behind it and like the actor who was there. We had a man playing Neil Armstrong. I'm blanking. Ryan Gosling playing Neil Armstrong for the first man on the moon. Yet a trip to the moon can give you more excitement than that film did.
I'd agree.
But it's true, the dynamics and the for all that CGI and technology has delivered, this is people using the most practical effects to show how they travel, the arts of magic, what it would be. And at this time, man had not been to the moon. Man did not have the technology to see what the moon can deliver, and this is what their thought process delivered. And it's a very, very interesting film, silent movie at that, that shows what they believe the moon would be and how they create elements of magic is something to be witnessed and appreciated. And it's available on YouTube. So I encourage everybody to check out this film.
Yeah, the oldest sci-fi movie ever on our list and absolutely one for the ages. And you can see so many ideas here. You know, the concept of space travel, of things living, of aliens living beneath the surface of the moon, of wizards being regarded as scientists. There's so much here that we still use today. It's crazy.
Yeah, yeah. So a lot of respect goes to that film. So I wanted to put that out there. 60 years later, the technology was available, but they made something a lot, I don't want to say less impressive, but it's something I feel that needs to be seen. Because for better or worse, my number nine is a PowerPoint presentation. And that is what makes it something. Yeah?
Yeah.
La Jetée from 1962. Now, this is a story...
Well done.
You know what it is? It's 12 Monkeys. This is 12 Monkeys. This short story, which again, you can find on YouTube. 16 minutes, if I'm not mistaken. I can't remember, but it's a short story that's narrated and it's literally clips. And you can practically hear the old projector screen go as the images come up and it tells you the story. Now that short 16 minutes was taken
and expanded and added Bruce Willis and Brad Pitt to give you 12 Monkeys. It's the exact same story of time travel and what it means and what certain visions meant. It's very impressive. Now, it's the fact that as much as we know what cinema is and motion, even with just a simple basic concept of a narrator and images, you can still build a film. And for that, that's why I made it my number 9. I nearly removed it for a much bigger franchise film that's out there, but that's probably been seen by a lot of people and it will continue to be seen because Disney Plus has it. Yeah. I'm not saying maybe on your list.
Disney Plus has it?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. It may be on your list. It may not be on your list. But it has one of the most iconic villains you can ever talk of. And I nearly made that, but I'm like, everyone knows about that film. I'll leave it as that. But this is something that is easily accessible. And
yes, you mean.
I don't know if it's on your list, so I keep quiet.
But it's not.
Okay, cool. Like, I nearly went Star Wars. I was like, yeah, we could do Star Wars and the grand element. Not Star Wars within number 9 and Darth Vader, the ultimate villain of pop culture. Luke, I am your father. I was like, no. This is something that's precious. That small 15 minutes made an entire film. It's a different way of projecting cinema. And for that reason, it maintains. There we are. Now,
well done. So you've brought a silent sci-fi film and a PowerPoint presentation. Season 1 AJ with Die Hard with a Vengeance is going, huh?
Technically, who knows? That may still be on the list. Right. In at number 8, we talk about the good. Let's bring in the bad at number 8. It's not my worst. It will not be my worst because some people would hate me for it if I called it my worst. Some would even throw a spoon at me for calling it my worst because in at number 8,
good,
is The Room.
Yes, of course.
Now,
this must be in the discussion. It has to be. This was nearly my number 10. And then I was like, I can't leave Buster Keaton off for Tommy Wiseau. But this
I said it. There are many films that could have fallen into this category of it's a way better film. It deserves to be in there. Let's bring back the argument once again. Star Wars could have been in there. You know, you could bring, I'm not going to bring anyone else. I could have quoted any superhero to be in there because of what it meant and where the franchise has now led to. This is a film that has no right in being made. This is a film that has questions of funding and everything, every element of what it has, the history behind it, like the disaster artist shows everything behind it. But you have to visually see this madness of a film and wonder how do people love this film. It's the maddest thing you could ever see. It has no every film has a beginning, middle, and end. That's the rules that it lives by. Not this one. Not this one. What is The Room about? Who knows? It's the vision of a madman, and somehow it's come out there and it has become something. So much so they had to talk about the making of this film. And it still makes no sense to anyone. It's just you didn't believe this is what actually happened. That this is how the scenes came about. This is what he said, and this is what's done. And people are paying to watch this film year in, year out. Sometimes it's the same people paying to see this film year in, year out. It makes no sense, but some people love it and understand it. Others are like, I will never watch this again in my life.
Oh, I will. I definitely will.
I'm not in a rush to watch it again, but it's something that it has been in. Forrest Gump is a sorry, I don't know if that's in your list. Gump is a film that I have seen once and has lasted with me forever. Because of the emotional stories, the jokes, and how they intertwined it into history.
You've The Room. Forrest Gump once. Damn.
I've seen parts of it along the way, but I always cut off because I'm like, it's not the beginning. And then I go away. But it's quite magnetic, so I do stay for quite a while.
Sure.
The Room is absolute madness. The disaster artist explained it even more, and I was like, what is going on? But it's absolute insanity, yet it's a film. Now, we can all talk about, please forgive me if I say this, any of your films. Fight Club, The Warriors, A Clockwork Orange, all of these have been cult films. Hell, even Donnie Darko, which really hurt me to have not put on. Again, I apologize if any of these
are on
your
list. Same.
Nothing is more cultish than The Room. It's the insanity behind it is one side, and the cult status of it is another. And for that, The Room has to be in a discussion.
It's what J.J. Abrams says at the beginning of The Disaster Artist, which always has stuck with me because I've seen The Room, I think now, somewhere between 4 to 6 times. It's not a good film. It all blends into one, right? And I was in various levels of sobriety when watching it at various times. But you are right. You want to talk cult and like what JJ says, which is like, we've all, you know, talking about him and his peers, we've all made movies that are, we're blessed to can, that lucky that people are saying, this is my favorite movie ever, or this is some of the best movie ever. No one's talking about my movie 20 years on. No one's talking about, and he, what is it he says? I think it's only Spielberg whose movies are still spoken about 20 movies on. Like, he's comparing Tommy Wiseau to Spielberg. Now, there's some truth in that, because obviously we're not ever attempting to say that Tommy Wiseau is an auteur or an ingenue like Spielberg. Of course not. But you've,
writer with the talents of Tarantino. But
you've got to give it to the guy for funding his own movie, making it outside of the Hollywood system, it being so bad that it caught fire and fascinated people to seek it out and watch it, that it's become so watched that it's actually now profitable. Like, that just doesn't happen. When movies are so bad, the word is stay away, don't waste your time, especially now in the modern day, and people are like, cool, I won't see it. This movie is lightning in a bottle. It, you know, it won't happen again that a movie is universally lauded as being one of the worst, most tremendous pieces of ever, and people are drawn to it like a moth to a flame.
Yeah.
Of course it's in the conversation for a movie a cinephile must watch. Because equally, if you are a cinephile or an aspiring cinephile, it would mean that you've seen a lot of great films. This is like how not to make a movie. Which should be definitely absorbed and watched as well. It's absolutely in the conversation.
There we are. That's my bottom three. Over to you, sir.
Great picks. Great picks. All right, my number 7. One I actually think I've only brought up once on the podcast, and I don't hear people talking about enough. I've got to bring in All About Eve.
I remember you bringing this up. Still not had a chance to watch it.
Dude, I was lucky enough to catch this during I think it was the first lockdown when we were going, when I was doing that 100 great movies countdown. And this movie came up and Anya and I sat down watching it, not expecting much, but like, it's going to be good because it's, you know, in Empire's top 100. When I tell you, again, I'm looking at this through the prism of a cinephile. Are there movies that are more entertaining? Yes. Are there movies from the 1950s that I have preferred? Yes. But, you know, we're talking about evaluating movies with a critical lens here, yeah? You know, when you're watching like a Tarantino film, you become very, very aware of how good the dialogue is. Yes, we're following the story, but because the dialogue is so punchy and poppy, you become very well aware of it, which by proxy means you become aware that this is a very good script. Like, the way these character dialogues have been written, so you become aware of the writing, you're like, oh, this is good. Yeah, Tarantino watched All About Eve a few times, I can tell you that. The way that this movie is written is insane. I would go as far as to say, as in terms of a written narrative of paralleling two characters at various stages in their careers, one on the down, one on the rise, one on the low, one piggybacking off the other under false pretenses in order to gain fame. The way that the characters interact with each other is much like in the Tarantino film, so believable, whereby you could see like, yeah, I could be a fly on the wall here and visualize this conversation happening for real, but at the same time, so obscure and poppy and out there that you're like, this seems almost like beyond reality, that it becomes surrealism. I'm going to say it. I think this is the best script that I have ever seen written. I don't know of a better script out there. You know, it's made, I believe he wrote it as well. I don't think I'm going mad. but it was definitely directed by the brilliant Joseph Mankiewicz. They actually did a movie about him starring Gary Oldman on Netflix called Mank. It's got the late, great Bette Davis. It's got a debut. Yeah, it's the debut of Marilyn Monroe. It's about a girl who's, you know, Bette Davis is on the down in her career. And this girl called, I believe she's called Anne Baxter. I mean, I'm pretty sure it's Anne Baxter. Big super fan. The OG Stan, if you will. The OG Stan. Mooches her way into her life, wanting what she has. Starts off as her secretary and then muscles her way into actually being her career replacement. And it's this culmination of this power pull between, and you've got to remember, for this to be made in the 50s and for it to be focused on two women, it's just ahead of its time in its ideas. It's ahead of its time with its script writing. And I don't think it's ever been bettered. It's ahead of its time with its narrative ideas and dynamics of characters. You're looking at it and you really do have like an almost out of body experience if you've watched enough movies and you go, well, Jesus, I'm watching something. I'm watching history unfold in front of me here. And I don't hear people talking about All About Eve. And it's not like people haven't heard of Bette Davis or Marilyn Monroe or Joseph Mankiewicz. These are big, big names.
Yeah.
I believe you still haven't seen it.
No, I haven't. It's on the list.
Must watch. Yeah,
that's what this. That's what this list is all about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And cool. Dude, my number six. If there was any further evidence that you were a cinephile, you introduced me to this one.
You keep bringing it up, and I know. Do you know what? It was on my list, and I realized I forgot it. I know exactly which one it is. The minute you say that,
Double Indemnity.
Yeah,
dude, the Godfather, the Granddaddy, the Hulk Hogan of noir films.
Yeah,
like what Hulk Hogan is to wrestling, this film is to the noir genre. The original Femme Fatale and Barbara Stanwyck, the brilliant Billy Wilder directing it, a movie that is so beautiful in its simplicity. It's like insurance salesman goes to woman, realizes that she's trying to commit murder, ends up being seduced into her web of murder and intrigue, and partaking in that murder, knowing that the husband's insurance has a double indemnity clause, meaning that if he dies in strange circumstances, it's double whammy money, money, baby. And they're going to split the wealth.
Yeah.
But the movie does a reverse narrative trick because it starts with the end again. Now, where have we seen a lot of this happen before? Every single modern movie? Like, the influence of having the femme fatale, the reverse narrative. I mean, again, I bring up his name, Tarantino, Nolan in Memento, Robert Rodriguez and Frank Miller in things like Sin City. Like every single great modern noir film I can think of, I'm like, you got all your ideas from Double Indemnity, didn't you? Literally, it's the blueprint for the noir genre.
Yeah.
You know, I'm looking at Chinatown. I'm like, oh, Roman Polanski, you also like Double Indemnity. It's a good film, isn't it, bro? Like, yeah.
Yeah. I believe his name was Will Brooker. That was my uni teacher for the short spell that I was in there. And he was the one who introduced me to that film. So I thank you, Will, if you do happen to stumble across. Yes, that short time I was there, you left an impact. So much, you influenced both silver screen dudes. Yeah,
for sure. For sure. So simple, but so powerful. Your seven, please, AJ.
My seven was actually mentioned in our news story, and believe it or not, it's the first time I've watched it. But we need to acknowledge what it is, because this runs the House of Mouse. Had this failed, and the battles that Walt Disney went to in order to make it happen, he nearly didn't make this film, and Walt Disney would not be that powerhouse that it is. Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Like, yep. I actually had a really good time. Now, short confession, I've always said I've read the Disney books. Not the official books. I've not read the
Brothers, Grimm.
No, the Disney books. I've read those and I've been familiar with the stories, and that's how I knew her skin is white as snow, her mother's wish was da-da-da-da-da. I know it, but I've never actually watched it. It really dawned on me how much I've not seen Disney movies recently, and I'm like, I'm going to do it. Also helps for next week. But like, it dawned on me what is actually going on, and that's when it became something really impressive, and I've actually had quite a good time with this film. And let's be honest, we talk about what J.J. Abrahams talked about in the beginning of the disaster artist. To this day, with a film that is just shy of being 100 years old, the Brothers Grimm didn't describe that dress. You have little girls dressing up as Snow White, left, right, and center. Snow White is a name that has transcended for nearly 100 years because of Disney's vision. Because of that, we have had Dumbo, The Jungle Book, Pinocchio, hell, Moana, Elsa, and the rest. Like, this is all because of this, the success of this film. We talk about how Iron Man built the MCU, and even go back, Blade saved Marvel. This allowed Disney to be, Mickey Mouse is still Mickey Mouse. Let's not ever take that back. This is the first feature-length cell, I don't know the exact definition of what it is, movie that came out not only for Disney, but as a feature-length animation film. The rest is history.
Yep. I can't argue with anything you've said there. Hugely important in cinema history. And again, I think the animation remains beautiful to this day. I actually think that animation's taken a step backwards with the introduction of being completely computer-generated. Don't get me wrong. When Toy Story came along and changed the game, it was revolutionary and it was incredible to see, like, oh, wow, you can do this with a computer now.
The fact that you mentioned it very nearly made the list for me.
For sure. For sure. I would listen to an argument for that. But I am longing for an old hand-drawn cartoon animated movie. I mean, listen, we'll always have them. Disney Plus is a wonderful tool. You have a history of animation in there. But I do miss it.
I do. I actually prefer it a lot of times.
Like, me too. When
I look at a cartoon, I look at just the two versions of a Batman or a Spider-Man that you can get, and I look back and I really do prefer the old school stuff.
Yeah.
It is what it is. Yeah. Okay. In at number six, this one was really interesting because I realized I forgot a film that needed to be mentioned, and it may come up on your list. It may not, but I'm going to ask you the question all the same. What is arguably, not for me, not for you, I know that for both of us, what is arguably the greatest film of all time?
Citizen Kane.
Exactly. I personally didn't enjoy it, but I don't see the hype behind it. And for that, it didn't make the list. However, what did make the list for me, and I believe should be seen for everyone who appreciates the world's greatest film, is this little gem. RKO 281, because this is a movie about a movie. If you believe that Citizen Kane is the greatest movie, then why not take a step back and see how this film was? Again, the same way we talk about how Walt Disney went for a challenge and did not nearly lost everything in making it, so did Orson Welles.
Yeah,
Orson Welles went through an entire battle. Orson Welles nearly shut down Hollywood. That's how deep this is when it comes to it. And RKO 281 shows you, RKO is the production company and it was filmed 281.
Not Randy Orton.
Battle that went into it. Yeah, each time I say RKO, I'm really tempted to go, bro, like, out of nowhere. But this film really showed me so much of what cinema was, what the battle meant, and how it changed the game for cinema. Like, we might not even be talking film had the censors got what they wanted out of stopping this film.
Yeah.
It has to be seen.
So, I haven't seen this, but, you know, while we are on the topic of Citizen Kane, the reason it didn't make my list is it falls into this weird ground where, yes, as a cinephile, you definitely have to see Citizen Kane to understand what Orson Welles did with light, what he did with MacGuffins, you know, Rosebud, what he did with opening and closings, bookending movies, what he did with, some would argue it's toxic now, but what, how he presented strong, business-minded, male-focused narratives back then. They were the talk of the town. That movie definitely changed cinema. Objectively, I can see why people say it's the greatest film ever, because it ticked so many boxes in terms of change and progression. For a lot of people, it lacks the entertainment factor. But I do think it's one that will be spoken about forever, so I didn't feel compelled to edutain on it.
But here's the thing, and this is what I thought behind it. I felt like, where if someone loves films and they go, what's the greatest film of all time? That will be in the list.
Yeah.
Because to this day, it's still one that people talk about. Just take a step back. And I feel that if you do appreciate that film, or you appreciate cinema, and this is the game changer film, have a look back at how it came about. And that's why I thought it's a hidden gem of a film a cinephile should check out.
Very interesting pick. Not, didn't see that one coming, AJ. Very interesting pick. All right, my number five. Going war movie now. And there's so... This was very hard to narrow down. This was very hard to narrow down. I nearly went with the movie that I could have argued, oh, this is a war movie, which is not a war movie, in Apocalypse Now. So close. So, like, still, no, I'm like, oh. But then I'm like, but what influenced Apocalypse Now? And it's my number five, which I would argue has probably influenced every single war movie that followed. And that is 1933's All Quiet on the Western Front.
Haven't seen it. I've heard of it 100 times, but not seen it.
Well, it's been remade.
Yes, I'm aware of that as well.
There is a Netflix remake, which I've heard is serviceable, which I've heard is pretty, pretty good. What All Quiet on the Western Front did is that it was the first anti-war movie of its kind. You know, prior to this, when you would see, first off, prior to this, it was hard to even conceive of doing a war movie because of the scope and spectacle that was needed, and the medium of cinema didn't really permit that type of scale to be captured.
It might have also been a bit soon as well, I can appreciate.
Well, you also got to remember, being so soon, with the threat of the Weimar Republic rising in Germany, and, you know, there was talk amongst the more educated corners that, hey, there may be another war with Germany in the not-too-distant future. Boy, were they right. You know, when war movies were made, they were very much made as propaganda tools, you know, to much like the scouts were, you know, good old Lord Baden-Powell, who had a building named after him opposite the Lycée. You know, the scouts were created to put ideas of propaganda and, you know, jingoism into young boys to be like, defend your country, dulcet decorum est pro patria mori, and all that. All Quiet on the Western Front really took the initiative to be like, nah, wars, don't go near that stuff. And it showed war for what it was, not as a glorified propaganda tool, not as like some traumatic but bombastic big battle event. No, as moments of peace, bookending moments of anguish with a lot of noise all around it. Young boys, they go to war in the trenches in World War One. There's the battle scenes in them obviously don't have the grandiosity of the more modern battle scenes, but you can see what they're doing has clearly influenced the directors and movie creators that have followed this movie throughout the following 100 or 90 years, I guess. It's quite the spectacle. And, you know, it created, you know, even Spielberg, I can imagine him with some of the ideas for movies that I'm sure we're going to talk about later, looking at this and going, oh, that's a good idea. So make something happen that they don't see. Make it happen off camera. I mean, literally the final shot of this movie of just the butterfly landing on the ground will send shivers down your spine. It's timeless. It's absolutely timeless, this film, and the message behind it will be valid forever. All-timer.
Nice. And that was your number five?
That was my five.
So my number five is the punt from earlier.
Yeah.
Jurassic Park.
Oh.
I toyed with this because there was another film and I knew you would have the other film because essentially we talk about blockbusters and there is the blockbuster. Yes. Like, he's got that. I don't need to worry about that.
Yes.
But it's the element of the unseen. What this done is, and that one gave you fears, and I'm going to leave it there because you will sell it later on. This one recreated the past and put the fear of God in people again. It's like, oh, dinosaurs are long gone. But what if we could recreate it and it had the entire world buzzing about it? We, as the silver screen dudes, two cinephiles, will go out there
and try
to do an episode that said the top 10 best dinosaur movies. We both had a guaranteed number one because this film could never be replicated. Even the creator of this film could not replicate it in the other way. You had two franchises, World and, what is it, Park and World.
Park and World,
then brought both worlds together and still could not bring the magic that this film has done.
No chance. It not even brought close. Brought
back these animals. And let's be honest, everyone knew Diplodocus and T-Rex. Like, it was that, Triceratops. Like, you could name the Power Rangers. After that, it gets a bit difficult for some people in terms of what you call dinosaurs.
Some people.
I was not aware of a specific dinosaur and it gave me the shivers for the longest while. We'll just leave it as that because we don't have the time to go into it. This film is, you had the fear of the unseen. This made the extinct alive again and put the whole world to talk about it. And its practical effects that to this day have not aged. I feel that anyone who appreciates cinema has to appreciate Jurassic Park. It's a common name, so it's one of the more bait, as it were. But it needs to be in a discussion that if you haven't seen Jurassic Park, you need to see Jurassic Park.
The only thing, you've said that, couldn't have said it better. The only thing I will add to it is that you've got to remember this film is now 30 years old. There are definitely one generation, but possibly even two generations that have not grown up on this and very likely may not have seen it, right? Yeah. Louis, our friend of the channel, Louis Beneventi, who's appeared on our podcast before. I watched Jurassic Park with him the first time literally a few weeks ago. You know, he's upper echelons of Gen Z. So you've got everything that comes below him and the next generation of kids too. Because I'm imagining our generation and the one below, you know, 10 years and down, they've grown up and had the Jurassic Park buzz. Louis' generation and the one after him, basically the kids now who are our age when this movie first came out, have no way have they seen Jurassic Park. So we are.
Did
now
he appreciate it?
Oh, he loved it.
That's what I wanted to hear.
He was met, and he went into it quite like dinosaur sci-fi cloning, just like Anya, and then. Without fail, I've never watched someone. I actually enjoy seeing people see Jurassic Park for the first time now because it gives me flashbacks. But I've never watched someone look at Jurassic Park for the first time and be like, meh, everyone. It's what it did for all of us when it first came out. It just showed you, like, cinema can be life-altering. This movie is life-altering. It literally changes your perception about what wonder can be.
And I just maintain the closing statement for me on it will be films came before, films came after. We went from top 10 best dinosaur movies to top 10 worst because it was such it was so cut and dry that nothing has matched what this film can create.
Nothing. Very few films, forget dinosaur films, yeah. Very few films can match this film. And podcasts are made for younger generations now. And I imagine there is going to be a growing number of people who have heard of it, definitely, may not have seen it. Get on it, guys.
Yeah.
So my number four, yeah?
Yep.
Okay, we're getting serious now. So we have to go foreign, and one of the most influential directors of all time, Jean-Luc Godard, in a film that I know most people won't have seen. It's on Vimeo without subtitles, though. So you must speak French. Otherwise, you can AJ Vision this, or, you know, jump on Amazon and buy the DVD or restored 4K DVD remaster ultra thingy.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Jean-Luc Godard directing and François Truffaut writing A Bout de Souffle, which translates to the wider world as Tarantino's second favorite movie, Breathless.
I've heard of this one, but you've brought it up before, right?
Of course. Well, of course you will have heard of it. It's one of the coolest films ever made. Now, when I talk influential, this is crazy. The first proper fourth wall breaks. The first time an edit, like the jump cutting in the editing, they were so experimental with this. You know how usually they'll jump cut in a movie to the beat of the music? They were jump cutting in this movie to the beat of the dialogue. And it was like, when I see you, you will come here. And it's like, what the hell are you doing? This is incredible. The first time you see a frame within a frame. So, you know, you see a character looking at herself in the mirror, but you're seeing that frame and the surrounding frame too. These are ideas. We were just talking about Jurassic Park. Think about when that T-Rex comes out the gate and you're seeing inside the car what they're seeing of the dinosaur outside, you know, through the windscreen, the frame within a frame. All of this comes from Breathless. The idea of the suave, quick-talking gangster wanting to talk to the and the girl being attracted to the man who's, you know, who she shouldn't really like, but she does. All that comes from Breathless. Betrayals and twists that you don't see coming. All that comes from Breathless. When you watch this film, if you are a film fan and are just like looking for some entertainment, oh, this film will entertain the living bejesus out of you because it's so stylish and stylistic. But if you're a cinephile who has watched a lot of movies, oh man, you're going to lap this up because it is like, you see Deadpool in it at some parts. Si vous aimez pas la montagne, si vous aimez pas la plage, si vous aimez pas la ville, si vous aimez pas Paris, allez vous faire enculer. Literally, drops a line like that, and it's like, okay. Top to bottom, this film changed cinema. Incredible.
Nice.
Jean-Luc Godard's Breathless, one of the all-timers.
Nice. I like that. Cool.
Number four. On it's Vimeo, so check it.
This is either a punt, or you're going to say it's your number three. It's clear cut as that. RKO 281 was a movie about a movie. This is a movie about making a movie that you introduced me to, and it's an absolute classic. It's a musical. We are talking Singing in the Rain.
Yeah, it's my number three.
I just knew.
You know what the rest of my list is, don't you?
Yes.
You're such a pig.
I do.
You may not know the order, but you know the movies, don't you?
I'm pretty sure I could guess the order as well, to be honest. I'm torn, but yeah, I know. Yeah, I do.
Okay.
There's magic in this film that I didn't know I could still get, if I'm honest.
Yeah.
It's something that there was something vintage about watching it. And you're like, again, not that you underestimate people, but it's like one of those things, like what you said about Up last week. You can hear about a film. You can hear it's great, but I'll get around to it. And what you told me about this film was like, because it's going to match what's coming up in the next episode, I'll give it a shot. Let's see what it's about. The magic that came from it, the style, the grace of everybody in that film, the comedy that I did not expect in there, of how they show people trying, like you have the most
eye-catching star, but she is wasted as an actual actress who needs to actually use dialogue, and how they have to try and change it, and how the people overact because that's, you know, expression was the way to show stuff without words, and how it all blends into something was just absolute magic and gold. And I'm keeping it really short because, one, for you to sell, two, I'm appreciating the time that we've got. But wow, I did not expect to enjoy something old as much as I did in the current age. Exactly. Yeah. I didn't expect that.
And that's the perfect, that I'm not going to add, because that's the perfect way to end it. When you, it's perfectly normal as a modern audience to think, ugh, okay, yeah, old film, I suppose I have to watch it to ticket. And then, you know, I'll find some sort of critical appreciation for it. And I can look at it through the lens of, okay, yeah, you know, it's not going to be on my top 10, but I understand how this film is in, how this film influences that. Oh, God, no. Singing in the Rain is a top 10 of all time for me. I could, just like you, AJ, I still can't quite fathom how much I love this film. The story is wonderful. The double life story is wonderful. The character interactions are wonderful. The set pieces and the singing and the dancing are wonderful. And I will go so far as to say, I'll go out on a limb and say, even if you don't like musicals, I think you'd be hard pressed to watch this and say, I don't like it. I don't know how it's possible to like movies, even as someone who likes movies and doesn't like musicals, and then say, I don't like Singing in the Rain. It's like, it's not possible.
It's really funny. After work, I was kind of having a discussion. As this guy goes, I hate musicals. And I was like, you need to try Singing in the Rain. And someone else had not seen it. Oh, you're a bit soft. And I was like, mate, come at me as much as you want. Watch it and then come back to me. And then my mate, John, who knows films, is like, it's actually a pretty good film. And, you know, he brings up Donald O'Connor for just because of the magic that he has. It's just what it is. You can't deny it.
Okay. So that was your four and my three. So over to your three.
Back to my number three. I hate when I do this, when I look at a list and I keep going down and I was like, it feels too high. It feels too high. No disrespect to the film. It feels too high based on like the classics and madness that's come out there. This is more fresh. And this is something that would not have been on my list had it been 2 years ago, because I thought it was overrated as hell. But I'm going to give you the breakdown as to why it's there and the logic behind what it is. Now, we talk about blockbusters and we talk about something. We talk about the advancement of cinema. Still feels a bit weird saying it, but I'm going to say the name because I can't waste time. Avatar is my number three.
Okay.
Now,
I get it.
We talk about the advancement of cinema. I've always said, before I fell in love with Avatar, Avatar is one of the most beautiful films you can ever see. And my biggest regret is, as much as I hated the film, I wanted the opportunity to see it in the cinema. Death Taxes, AJ talking about comic book movies. I was celebrating that Endgame knocked it off, because I was like, this is the film that needs to be the biggest box office draw. This is the blockbuster movie. You can, which film just says, okay, is that really it? Just does a mini re-release and outdoes Endgame. That's what they've done. They've just done a mini re-release to be like, enough, shut up.
Like a weekend, wasn't it?
It was like a weekend just to shut up everyone in the MCU. Like, oh, we lost? Really? Already? Damn. That's like what they've done.
Yeah.
Then there was another re-release because they're releasing a second film. And that's when I really learned the appreciation of this film. So not only can you outdo a film just for fun, you outdo yourself just for fun, because that's what Avatar does. It does that. It's one of the most visually striking films you will ever see. Pandora to this day is the biggest beauty I have seen created by man. So we're talking about the technology that's there. The fact that this film, for benefits, has great 3D benefits. And of course, I have to do it because it's the experience that I have grown to love and will bring me back to the cinema time and time again for these films, the 4D experience. This film was built to give you every sensation required. The air, the splashes of water, the movement of everything in there. You won't get that. And I'm not going to trash a film, but I will say, I remember watching trailers and being like, Black Adam's going to be good, but it's not going to be as good as Avatar. That's what I remember. Like the movement of Black Adam when I was in the trailer, like, maybe. By the time Avatar finished, I'm like, there's no way you're going to have every strike and beat what they do, because it wasn't built for that. What James Cameron done with this film was, it was built for that experience. And that's the thing. So not only is this a blockbuster movie, not only is it a visual beauty in normal format, it's a 3D visual beauty, and it's a 4D experience.
like none other. And for that, it is something that needs to be appreciated. Is it a long movie? Hell yeah. And I've been both sides of the coin, people. But there are many reasons why this film needs to be watched and appreciated in various different formats, as per what I've just listed.
I agree with everything you've just said. Nothing to add.
Thank you very much. You're number two, sir.
You're such a dick. You know what it is. Yeah, my number two, it's the original blockbuster movie. It's Jaws. It had to be Jaws. Jaws had to be on this list. What I love about Jaws is that it's the argument you can give people. Every year that this film gets older, by proxy, the shark looks worse and the shark looks older. And so people's commitment to say, oh, it's old and it's dated, it's like, yeah, no, but that makes it that much more special, because you get to double down even harder on the fact of, you know, you only see the shark in total cumulatively about 6 minutes.
Yeah.
This, yeah. It, like, obviously it's a shark movie, but it's so, so far removed from, even take Jurassic Park. It's same field, same spectrum of incredible historical blockbuster, but it's the opposite end of the spectrum, where Jurassic Park was a show and tell event, right? It's like, here's me telling you, I'm going to make you believe dinosaurs are real. Look. Jaws is like saying, I'm going to hide everything from you and just give you three characters to focus on, and you're going to be eating out of my hand just based on the social hierarchy narrative that I'm going to be telling you through the views of a policeman, a scientist, and a fisherman on a boat talking about life while being hunted by a shark.
Yeah.
It's timeless.
Yeah.
And it, even more so because of the shark looking old, makes the rest of it that much more impactful. It's like, oh, so the shark, every year it looks worse. It's like, oh, it can look that bad and it can still be this good. Like, dude.
And people are still scared to get in the water because of that. Yeah. It's an argument to be said.
Yeah.
Yeah. Jaws is something that needs to be rewatched by me. Like, don't get me wrong, I have seen it. I've watched it countless times as a kid. I recall that. But I can't, it needs to be refreshed. And that's what my problem is into why Jaws didn't make the list. And I knew it would be on your list, and it was that or Jurassic Park. I was like, yeah. Spielberg's definitely worthy of having more than one entry in here. But I was like, that Jurassic Park, I'm more comfortable talking about it. And
I had to put them both on. It felt like a cheap shot, but I was like, I have to.
Bro, I get it. So I'm going to say over to you, because this next film is my number two, but I know for a fact it's your number one. So.
Should we not do worst first?
I was going to say, that's the thing. There is the benefit of the punt of the worst. So you can say punt, and then worst is going to deny you.
You just want me to say punt because you're that sure?
Guaranteed.
Okay, here we go. So AJ's number two. I don't know what it is, but oh, okay, fine.
Right, one of the most guaranteed things I know, just based on the passion that came when you first mentioned this film. Right, okay. Would you like to go with your worst?
Yeah. So I rewatched it for this list, and I haven't changed my opinion about what fundamentally annoys me about this movie. It's not a bad film. I don't think you could watch this movie as a standalone cinematic experience and be like, oh, this movie's terrible. No, it's not terrible. It's a very well-made, very accomplished film. But when we're talking about overhype, I mean, Jesus wept. The fact that people... let me just say the name to start with. It's Casablanca. Because when you talk about, like, people saying this is an all-timer and... I'm like, why? I mean, I feel like it's like the opposite of Waterworld. Let me explain. Like, you watch Waterworld, like, the hate that Waterworld gets is not justified. Go on.
It's like watching Troy. The opposite of Troy.
No. I'm going to stick with Waterworld just because Waterworld, there was that whole media campaign that was out to destroy it.
Okay.
You know, like the world went anti-Waterworld and there was like a vendetta against this movie. And I'm of the opinion, like, I'm sorry, if I can buy Dominic Toretto strapping duct tape to his car and going into outer space for family and being able to suspend disbelief and enjoy it, I can believe that the polar ice caps melted and we've evolved to kind of cope with that and be water people. Like, fine. Yeah. Do I think the movie is like, you know, seven stars in the Tokyo Dome? No, obviously not. But do I think it's deserving of the hate and vitriol that it was met with when it first came out? Absolutely not. And that's why I say that the Casablanca is the opposite of this, because the universal praise that this movie receives about being an all-timer, one of the greatest love stories, one of the greatest settings, brilliant dialogue, fantastic cinematography. I'm looking at it and I'm going, they're all fine. Like, I'm not looking at the acting and going, the acting's bad. No, the acting's great. I'm not looking at the story and going, oh, the story's bad. No, the story's really good. But where? What is it delivering that is so deserving of being put in the same conversation as, you know, all the other great movies of years gone by or of even of modern day? I'm like, it doesn't reinvent the wheel. It doesn't do anything exceptional. The acting isn't something, you know, there's nothing that freaking Humphrey Bogart does in this that I would say, you know, oh, yes, he's up there with Daniel Day-Lewis. I'm like, do one. Like, never. Like, he's not, you know, he's Tobey Maguire level as far as I'm concerned. Like, people seem to like Tobey Maguire and rate him as an actor. Yeah, he's about that level. Like, I'll put you in front of a camera, hit the record button, and I know I'll get a performance out of you. Very good. But he's no Steve McQueen, bro. He's no James Garner. Like, how this guy is heralded as one, he's no Errol Flynn. How this guy is being considered one of the all-time great actors, I will never run. He's no Gene Kelly. He's no Jimmy Stewart. Like, these are the great actors, you know? I don't get it. I don't get it with Humphrey Bogart. I don't get why this is supposed to be such a great love story. Frankly, I think he's a grumpy see you next Tuesday, as I've said to you numerous times. And I don't find the love story particularly engaging or relatable or believable for that matter. I don't think it's a question of, oh, you need to be hopeless romantic. No, not really.
I recall myself one and I missed it.
Yeah.
I have been called romantic by a lot of people. And, look, you know,
La La Land makes me cry. I'm a sucker for a romantic story. You know what I mean? Yeah. But the movie's good. You know, as I said, if you watch it as a standalone experiential thing, it will not disappoint or do anything wrong to you. But when you're looking at it through the prism of this is an all-time great movie, I'm like, for what reason? Not even no. Just now I'm failing to look at it with a critical lens, because I'm looking at it with a critical lens and I'm like, what does it do that makes it deserving of being, you know, 5-star, 100% grade A movie perfection? I'm like, where? It's fine. It's good. It's fine. Yes, I've watched it. Move on.
I agree. I didn't hate Casablanca. I was just like, is that it? That's what I felt. One of the films that I think is now being panned by the nation, by everyone, but I really enjoyed, and it's not in my list, is Gone with the Wind. Like, I actually was able to stick with this film throughout, whereas Casablanca, I was just like, oh, okay. Is that it? You know, and here we go, talking about Mr. Emotional. I remember, like, Mariah Carey has a song called Love Story. I just thought, it's not going to end up like this Casablanca story. I was like, my God, this has to be such a heartbreaking story. I watched it. I was like, that. Okay. I was just like, so unfazed. So unfazed. I was just like, okay.
So I was so like, agree. Okay, yeah, next. Cool. Yeah. I've watched it. Yay, I've watched it. I can tick it off my list. You know?
Yeah, it was a box tick for me. It was. Yeah. I would agree with you on that. Now, This is a bit of a cheat because I've not seen the film in its entirety, and I brought it up recently. So it's there. Now, we talk about a film that every cinephile must watch and films that have had great impact. And the fact that I have not seen this entire film, yet it had a great impact, and I believe every cinema, any cinephile must not watch this film. So I'm being, that's how it falls into worst.
Tammy and the T-Rex.
That was awesomely terrible. That falls under awesomely terrible because that I just couldn't believe what I was watching. But again, terrible dinosaur movie. This one was brought up just a few weeks ago and it will come up again. But The Birth of a Nation. Like, the celebration and the influence it had. Like, in its time, it could possibly be classified as a blockbuster, obviously, just that cinema.
Sure. At that time. For sure. But it
influenced an entire nation to have some of the most hateful racial views that you could ever imagine. And so much so that it even influenced law. Because of the ignorance that these filmmakers had and somehow had the right spin doctors to make it look like the right way for people to think and, you know, fear the colored man. I say the colored man, not that it's a term, but it's because, yes, it's the black man in this film, but I'm sure the Asian community wouldn't have been too far if they chose, you know, if the Birth of a Nation Part 2 was to come out. But it I just find it disgusting. 13th, the documentary on Netflix showed part of it. And what it done, and obviously progressed further down. But I just find it disgusting and hurtful. And it's, yes, you might be, oh, the black guy defending black people. Cool. Whichever way you want to wave that flag, wave it. And if that's the way you see it, then it obviously shows what kind of sector you believe in. And you'd obviously probably have the film as your number one. And you don't want, you wouldn't be watching this because there's no way you're going to watch an N talk for an hour and 11 minutes. So it would really ruin your screen, I imagine. But I'm just, the levels of disgust, I feel like, don't get me wrong, it's the same. If we were a book club, Mein Kampf would be under my worst. I'm not here to promote hate. I will probably one day watch this film because I'm interested in what people's thought processes are. Now, you have stuff movies and you have all other stuff that can disgust people. And there are other stuff that will probably get you arrested, R. Kelly movies. But what I'm getting at with this is I just find it vile to be able to incite hate to such a degree. Yeah, it will remember worst.
Yeah. All right. Well, the punt then.
Yeah, go for it. It's all you. It's all you.
Seven Samurai. Arguably one of the most. Well, I don't think it's arguable. I think it's factual at this point. One of the most influential films ever made. Seven Samurai. Like, it doesn't matter if it's an episode of The Mandalorian or if it's freaking Tremors. Like, everything is Seven Samurai at this point. Group of samurai ronins are assembled together to go and defend a local village from an invading force. Insert that concept anywhere. Warriors defending people against invading force. It all started with Seven Samurai. Akira Kurosawa working with his muse Toshiro Mifune to great effect. And you've really got to just look at this through a number of different layers. One is, again, we talk about beauty and simplicity like we did with Double Indemnity. There's, when a story is simple and it's executed correctly, it's a thing of beauty. When a story has the ability to deliver something grandiose, like a Jurassic Park or an All Quiet on the Western Front or a big samurai battle, it's a thing of utter bewilderment. When you can have wonderful choreography like Singing in the Rain or like sword choreography like in Seven Samurai, when you can have larger than life characters like in Some Like It Hot playing counterparts of themselves, much like Toshiro Mifune coming to terms with the sobriety in Seven Samurai. Do you see what I'm doing here? Every single movie in some way, shape, or form, other than The General, which obviously came out before, every single movie I'm pinpointing here has in some way been influenced by this incredible Seven Samurai, or at least influenced it in turn if it came out before. They're all wonderfully woven and interconnected. But, you know, you look at this through the lens of a Western audience member, like, how often do we get really good samurai movies? It's just not a thing. It doesn't happen. So it's, you know, it's a rare treat to see something like this. How often are we able to experience foreign films which are this long, because it is a 3-hour film, which for so many people can be a turnoff, but you just hit play on it, you give it a chance, and you're in, you're absorbed. From the first few minutes, the film just whoosh, pulls you in and doesn't let you go. It's incredible. It is, I would argue, the most influential film of all time.
See, I appreciate that, and I love the examples you gave about, you know, what I think it's seeing a film. Let's bring up the poster. Yours is cropped a lot better than mine. The greatest foreign language film ever. Now, that's the BFI. And it's not that we live by the hype that other media outlets will put out there. But there is something in it to be appreciated. This film is aged. It's, you know, it has a lot of age on it, but it's still a timeless piece. And that's what you need to appreciate. It's something that, as you say, it's the influence. It's the beauty of the fact that it doesn't have to be a Western movie to be appreciated. And that's what I love about it. Like, there are many others, you know, I wouldn't dare quote, yes, Parasite could be in a list for cinephiles, but something, I feel that as a cinephile, you need a bit of age to it. And this is what, more than anything, it's about capturing the past. This is what I saw this episode about. It's about capturing certain moments along the way. And each one that I've shown has had their reasons behind it, their battles. You know, we could all talk Star Wars. We could all talk the MCU all day long. And this isn't a Disney bash, because you could talk every version of Batman out there. But these are names that we can all quote. And that's the thing. How many people can truly say Seven Samurai? You know, you start hearing something along that line, you start thinking Magnificent Seven, which is the direct Western remake. You start thinking stuff like Hateful Eight. You start thinking of all these other numbers. You'd even go Ridiculous Six, whatever the hell that crap was called there.
Yeah.
Marini's Kodan, I can't remember. But that's the vibe that comes with it. But this capsule is something to be appreciated and to be seen. That if you do feel that you can appreciate every... Let's go to it. We talk Marvel and we talk the one that saved Marvel, Blade. Well, who else was wielding a sword before that? My love for Kill Bill and Hattori Hanzo and everything that's mentioned there. It's all influenced by this. It goes back. And that's what needs to be appreciated with it. So, yeah. I understand why it's your number.
Yeah, I know what your number one is too.
Of course you do. I know you do. And I feel that as something in it, the key thing, I remember what I was on the train this morning, on the way back from work, and my thing was exactly what you said earlier. The beauty in simplicity. Now, this is literally just a play in film. All set literally in one room over one day. Just nothing but 12 angry men to discussing a court case. That's all it is. It's a simple battle. There's no visual effects. There's no flashbacks. There's not even a reveal of did the guy do it or not. Sorry for the spoiler, people. It's just a question of if you have reasonable doubt, you have to find the person not guilty. It's an instant, oh, this is cut and shut. Let's go this way. It just takes one man to stand up from the crowd and be like, but what if? And that one question challenges every person. Whether they agree or disagree, it's not for me to spoil that film for you. I have a passion for law dramas and stuff like this. It's just something that catches my eye. But I feel that we could talk about films in one location. We could talk about films without visual effects, films set in one day. There are so many different angles, and each time it has made its way to number one. The first time you brought up this film to me, I said, you what? And that is why I thought, this is why I believe the passion I have and the excitement I have each time I talk about 12 Angry Men, I believe should be shared to anybody who feels that they are a film fan. That's, as I said, started the show, I will end the show. It's not if you're an action star fan. I can give you 10 action films just like that. Die Hard, Free BMW.
True Lies, do it.
Yeah, do you know what I mean? Like, it's there. You want Marvel, I can list them all. I can say them backwards, I can say them forwards. It doesn't really matter. But films that are great, films that, as much as you follow Rotten Tomatoes and you go and you see it and you see that Mission Impossible's got 96% and this one's got that, it's films that have piqued your interest. How often would you go and just check to see what's in the 100% list and have no clue what it's about? This is one of them. Who or what is 12 Angry Men? I was like, you what, when I heard it. The beauty that I got from this film, and I fear that it will be lost, and I can't see it be lost, and that's why it's my number one.
Nothing to add. Well said. Very well said. I'm going to make this the easiest Rushmore ever.
Okay.
Our 3 points plus your number one.
Cool. Bear with me a second, just because my phone's on the other side. What was... Oh, Jesus. As simple as it is, here we go. I agree with you totally, by the way. I'm not going to argue. So we've got... Yeah. And oh, typical. It's just like, what was the free joint? That was
come on.
Okay, yeah, cool. Yeah, got it. If you could take, yeah, I'll write it here for now.
Have you got it?
Yeah.
Are you ready to go, yeah?
Yep.
Ladies and gentlemen, for the first time in Movie Mount Rushmore history, two cinephiles give to you the Movie Mount Rushmore of movies every cinephile must watch in no particular order. Our first entry is
12 Angry Men.
Our second entry is
7 Samurai.
Our third entry is
Singing in the Rain.
And our final entry into the movie Mount Rushmore of movies every cinephile must watch is
Jurassic Park.
What a list.
Yeah.
That, my friend, is movies.
Sorry, it's so weird because I believe I was being overheard and I'm being sent people's favorite movies, and I'm like, they're nice. Don't get me wrong, I don't know if they're cinephile movies, but yeah. That's the first time I've ever had a text message over what films are what. That's pretty cute. Yeah, what a list. Guys, it stretched a bit, but it's all with good reason. Now, as a cinephile, you should have seen all of these movies, and now you have the biggest challenge, because we the Silver Screen Dudes had the easy challenge. We just had to pick four. El Capitan, El Numero Uno, the best of the best of the best, sir, with honors. And in the end, and to quote Highlander, in the end, there can be only one. And how do you crown the one? Well, that's pretty easy. You head on over to at Movie MT Rushmore, or more importantly, at Movie Pulse, you fronted by good old JT from We Love Movies. And that's the person who retweets. So you only get one vote. And there you will get to vote between Jurassic Park, Seven Samurai, 12 Angry Men, and Singing in the Rain to crown the ultimate film that every cinephile must watch.
It's been beautiful. It's been great. I can't wait to see what some of the boys have to say with some of your movie selections. Like, AJ, you watch these movies? Like, yeah, he does. Yeah, he does. And it's so wonderful to see how we have both watched so many movies over the course of the last 6 years, and how we are both unadulterated film fans, film lovers, film buffs, cinephiles, cinemarxists, cine whatever. We love movies, and we hope you love movies too. And we are going to see you guys, as always, next week with the latest top 10 show, hopefully with a guest, but TBC on that one.
Okay.
TBC at the moment still. But until we see you next time, guys, whether you're watching us on YouTube or listening to us on Spotify or on any other podcast platform, we thank you, and we will see you next week. I'm Nico Luro.
The one AJ.